Blog Talk Radio.
Greetings and welcome to Mount Olympus. I am Hercules Invictus. The age of heroes has dawned and the quest for optimal wellness continues here at Tenafly Stigma Free. Tonight, it's my honor to be speaking with Miranda Thompson Lee, who is doing wonderful things in Tenafly and who's going to be doing even more wonderful things as time passes. Greetings and welcome, Miranda. How are you tonight?
Oh, I'm great, Hercules. It's so lovely to be talking to you.
The same here, and I'm really looking forward to learning more about you. You've made a splash here locally, and I'm looking forward to working with you.
Yeah, absolutely. Me too.
So how did your journey begin? What got you focused on optimal wellness?
So I am a mindfulness facilitator and a yoga therapist. And I have been practicing both meditation and yoga since I was a teenager. My mother took me to her yoga class, I think I was maybe 16. And I've been kind of on this journey of wellness using those tools since then. I remember particularly when I was doing my master's, I was doing a master's at Trinity Dublin in Ireland, and I was finding it very challenging and was getting quite stressed. So I took a deep dive into a form of yoga called Ashtanga and started practicing that daily and really continued doing that until I had my children. And then my kind of wellness with yoga and meditation fell apart for a bit because I don't know if our listeners have children or if you had children, but little kids and babies don't really allow you to have that 20 minutes of alone time to do your practices every morning.
I'm a parent as well, so I understand.
Yeah, okay, great. Yeah, so I was like constantly being interrupted, and I was like, I just don't know how to continue these practices which were helping me so much with, you know, dealing with stress and overwhelm and my, you know, the ups and downs of daily life. And it meant that I was becoming more and more stressed out and overwhelmed as a parent. And one day, you know, and this is in Tenafly where we live, you know, New Jersey, we get quite harsh winters. And I just remember this
yeah.
was a very snowy day. And I had a baby and a toddler, and I had to get them to drop them off at nursery school and then come back and do some work. And I'd wrangle them into their snowsuits, you know, which is like dressing a monkey, and got them out into the cold, which they didn't want to do because it was such a, you know, cold day, and got them into their car seats and strapped them in and just thought at that moment, I just don't know how I'm going to do this. This is so overwhelming. I felt like I'd done all the work of my day. and I think it was because I had this long-term yoga and meditation practice. And I just suddenly started taking some deep breaths. And I took a little walk around my car and sort of, you know, in retrospect, I can see that that's a meditation practice and mindfulness practice of calming myself down, of soothing my nervous system because I was looking, you know, at the sunlight dancing on the snow. And by the time I got back to my driver's seat, I felt so much better. I mean, not perfect, but a lot better, a lot more able to cope with this experience. And then there was this aha moment. I was like, oh, this is how I practice meditation now, because I really have no time for quiet except for these mindful moments in my life. And I started practicing these kind of mindful moments, you know, just walking around the car when I had like 30 seconds or so. And then I started teaching these practices to other parents who were also finding it overwhelming, you know, parenting small kids at the time. And mm-hmm. then it sort of grown into, you know, a business. I have now my own business called Find That Pause, where I teach, gosh, lots of different areas. I teach businesses, stress relief, stress management tools. I teach in libraries. I teach in schools. I teach all over Bergen County and lots of different places. The other aspect of my work, which came in almost at the same time as I was teaching parents, is I realized how stressed out our teens were. They seemed to be much more stressed than I felt I was as a teen. And I know that's not just in Tenafly, it's sort of all over the state. There's a lot of different reasons for that. But I wanted to help them too, and I thought, well, these tools I'm teaching parents are ideal to teach teens because, you know, whenever you're feeling stressed, you've got them to hand, right? You don't need to have someone, you know, like a therapist help you through something. You've got them for yourself at that moment to help you to calm down if you've got a deadline or you've got an exam coming out, or just to deal with that kind of stress and anxiety. So that was another area that I started, you know, training in and starting to teach.
Wow. I'm a meditator. I've been meditating for a very long time, for very many years, twice a day, once in the morning as I'm waking up and once in the evening as I'm retiring for the day. And I find it to be a phenomenal practice in that the negative voices that people have in their heads all the time, the critical voices, they seem to evaporate, very rarely ever there. And it really gives you a chance to become aware of how you're feeling, of your body and how it's feeling, of your mind and what it's thinking. And you really get a sense of where you are in the here and now, which in our busy schedules we tend to lose sight of sometimes. So I recommend meditation very highly to everyone. Can you tell me about the form of meditation that you're currently teaching and what it was based on? Because you said your mother took you to the yoga studio when you were 16. How has your meditative practice evolved beyond being more, beyond being shorter in duration?
So, oh my goodness. So I have studied and practiced in a lot of different styles of meditation. You know, I started off with my mom as a teen. I honestly couldn't tell you what kind of meditation that was. I imagine it was sort of more yogic breathwork meditation. I can't even remember now. But it was the, as you were saying, Hercules, it was the coming into the present moment and understanding that that was soothing or calming. Also, yoga is, I'd say, a moving meditation using movement and the breath synchronized to bring you into the present moment. So I have most recently sort of really deep dived into mindfulness practice. I trained with mindful schools. I did a year-long certification training so that I could teach their mindfulness curriculum to kids and teens. And that mindfulness is, you know, it's a practice that comes from contemplative Eastern practices, but it's was brought over to the U.S., well, the stream that I have studied with and my lineage is through a particular man called Jon Kabat-Zinn studying with Burmese monks and bringing those tools, those mindfulness practices back into secular settings because he was teaching in a hospital and he started something called the MBSR program, Mindfulness-Based Stress Reduction Program. And that's the program that most research has been based on for meditation and mindfulness practice, and that's the program that I have learned and now teach. But I bring in all the other kinds and forms of meditation where I think it's appropriate too. And I practice some other forms myself as well.
For people who are new to meditation, what would you say its list of benefits would be? Aside from the ones that we've already touched upon.
Yeah, I can outline those, but I also would love, if it would be okay with you, to do a very short practice, because I always find it's very good to talk about the theory of meditation, but it's actually just much better to practice it, and then you can kind of understand. But some of the benefits are it's incredibly good for your physical health. So one of the reasons we teach it, I teach at Englewood Hospital, and one of the reasons we teach meditation there, I teach cancer recovery patients, is it's very healing. There's this mind-body connection. I've also taught people with heart health conditions and other immune conditions because it helps to boost the immune system, tinnitus, all sorts of other kind of physical conditions can be helped through meditation. Chronic pain is another one. It's very good for focus. So again, another reason we teach it in schools for kids is like helping them to get less distracted, you know, because we live in a world where, gosh, everyone's looking at their phone a lot, you know, and so focus, the ability to focus has actually gone down, and this is a really good tool to help that. You know, focusing, as you mentioned, on the present moment, coming back to this moment. It helps with creativity and productivity. You know, if you're very distracted, it's not very easy to be creative or productive. And another area that I've been experimenting in is helping athletes. It helps. There's a benefit in terms of helping you to focus and perform better as an athlete. A lot of the big named athletes practice mindfulness meditation. Absolutely. It's incredibly versatile. You know, it's basically like going to the gym for your mind, I'd say.
I like that. That's a very powerful image. I can imagine that.
Yeah, so as we're very good, I think, about thinking about physical health. Well, this is talking about brain health, you know. And obviously the mind and the body, the brain and the physical self, they interrelate. So it's good to exercise both parts.
Now, I would love it if you did a guided meditation. That would be fantastic.
Okay, would that be a good moment?
There's no moment like the present, so go ahead.
Sure. So this is just a very simple one. I won't do it for too long, but I just think if anyone's listening and they've never practiced mindfulness meditation before, I'd like to just give you an introduction. So the first thing I do is always encourage people to sit in a well-thought-out way. So by that, I mean just placing your feet on the ground and feeling that connection between the feet. I always say the four corners of the feet, the big toe, the little toe, and the back two corners of the heel, and allowing that connection to the ground. And as you do that, bringing that sense of groundedness up from the feet into the legs and settling your sit bones, really settling them into the chair that you're sitting in. And oftentimes, as we do that, we start to sit up a little bit straighter and our chest becomes a little bit, expands out. The collarbone is really expanded to allow us to breathe well. Sitting upright but not uptight, so it's comfortable and relaxed. Inviting you to close your eyes if that feels good to you, but you can certainly just look down at your hands or down at the ground in front of you. And just notice what happens when we just sit quietly. Sometimes it can feel really good just doing that. And then inviting you just to see if you can keep that connection with the ground, with your feet. And also just start to feel your breath coming in and out of your body. Now, sometimes we can feel that more at the nostrils. There's a kind of airflow exchange at the nostrils. And sometimes it's more at the chest, lifting and falling of the rib cage. And sometimes it's at the belly. You're just noticing where your attention naturally goes. And if the breath is difficult at all, just coming back to that sensation of connection with the feet. And you might have noticed, if you're new to meditation, that your mind has started to wander and you're starting to think about something else, perhaps something you've got to do, perhaps the sound you're hearing. And if that's happening for you, that's absolutely normal. That's what the mind does. Yogis say it's like a racing horse. But what you can do is just notice yourself thinking or hearing or feeling something and bring your attention back to something in the present moment, like the breath or like your feet on the ground. And it's simply that returning to the present moment that's the practice of mindfulness.
Wow, that felt nice.
Yeah, thank you, Hercules. Glad you enjoyed that. Is that the kind of meditation that you practice, or is it something different?
The meditation that I practice started with Herbert Benson's book, The Relaxation Response. And
okay.
This is going back very many years. And from there, I explored different types of meditation that were around at the time, pranayama. I explored transcendental meditation. I explored, whatever systems I could find. And I found that after many years of experimentation, that what worked best for me is just relaxing my body from the bottoms of my feet to the top of my head, like slowly as I breathe in and out. And then when I get into alpha, doing some affirmations or visualizations or things that I want to accomplish. And once I accomplish what I've set out to work on, then I just let my mind go and relax and allow it to do what it will. So anything that wants to chatter in my mind can chatter in my mind without being censored. I allow myself to feel different areas of tension in my body and to go into the tension and see what type of memories or what type of thoughts come up with the tension, because a lot of times tension and stress are tied to psychology. So I just see what the tension tells me at the time that I enter it. And that's pretty much what I do, nothing special. Every now and then I experiment some more. Like right now I've decided to experiment with chakras. So that's my new adventure in working with my consciousness. So it's a journey I just began, but I'm really enjoying it. It's energized my meditative practice. So that's always a good thing.
Oh, yeah. No, that's a really interesting exploration. I'd love to talk to you perhaps another time about that. So, yeah, thank you. Thank you for sharing that.
I'm really impressed, and I am going to, as a result of this mini meditation, I am going to try to add two mini meditations to my day between my big one and my other big one, at the beginning and the end of the day. I'm going to try to do as you just showed us a couple of times and see what happens.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think there's formal meditation and then there's informal meditation. And I think, the history of meditation and where it came from, this contemplative practice, focuses more on the formal meditation, the sit down, the 20 minutes in the morning and the evening, which is a beautiful practice. And also, like I was explaining from my own perspective, I really got upset when I had children and I could no longer do that practice. And it was kind of like a grieving process for me, because this was something that I'd had in place for my life to help me feel well. And to lose it, because I was, a mother, was really hard. And so that's why I felt so grateful when I realized that actually this more informal kind of practice of fitting it in within your life could actually give you many of the benefits of a formal practice. And you didn't need extra time. You fit it in, when you had that 30 seconds, 1 minute to yourself. And I think that it resonates with a lot of people who have really busy lives, you know. Many of us don't have that, you know, that time to take the, that longer pause, but you can still find it in your life in these short ways. So I'd love to hear how that works for you.
All right, we'll definitely share it with you, and we will have a future conversation on chakras, because I'm really excited about chakras, so it'll be great to learn from you all that you've experienced and so forth. So being a mother, it deprived you of your meditative practice, but then it gave you what you currently have developed. So there was a greater purpose to it in terms of the healing energy that you're bringing to people of all walks of life and in all different circumstances.
100%. Whenever I always think of my children as my biggest Zen masters. You know, I studied with a lot of meditation teachers, but my children have been by far the biggest teachers for me. So yes, absolutely. And learning from them and learning how to bring meditation into my own life, into my own family, has been a big driver in what I do now. Absolutely.
Now, the different settings where you do the mindfulness meditation, you've already shared some of these settings and some of the benefits. Are there like variations in the meditation for different age groups or for people who are in differing sets of circumstances, like in terms of you know, pain management? Do people who are in pain do something different than people who are just stressed or you know, from life or work or and so forth?
Yes, absolutely. So when I work one-on-one with someone, when I do mindfulness coaching and someone comes to me with a specific problem or challenge in their life, I will look at all the research that's out there, look at different scientific research to show which practices are most beneficial for that kind of challenge. And now we have a lot of research to find out about that. So, for example, with chronic pain or indeed tinnitus, which is ringing in the ear, what you try and do is you actually try and help people to be able to sit with the sensation of pain or the sensation of tinnitus. So often what we do as human beings is we move away from these difficult sensations. And we have great, you know, a lot of big feelings around moving towards that. But as you work with someone in a very careful and delicate and sensitive way, moving towards the sensation, and I've seen this with my own students, you become able to sit with that pain for longer, able to sit with that those sensations of tinnitus for longer, and they don't become so overwhelmingly negative to you. And there's a lot of research around that. In fact, the beginning of bringing, I think I mentioned before, John Kabat-Zinn, that those are the populations that he worked with at first, was in chronic pain patients, bringing mindfulness to chronic pain patients. Because, you know, you're at the end of, like, what the doctors can do to treat you, so you have to move into other alternative therapies, and mindfulness is one of the ones that's been shown to really help people. And it's by moving towards rather than away from.
Yeah, that's a tough one. I know with the meditation, whenever I'm in pain, the meditation's useful like maybe 99% of the time. There's always the 1% where I can't detach myself from the pain or acknowledge the pain and keep it in the moment. But it works most of the time.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's very important to be very gentle and very kind when we practice any of these different practices, because we're working, you know, with challenge, right? There's a reason why we don't want to think about the pain. So we do it gently. There's this idea of titration. So you move towards and then you move away and you move towards and you move away. And just going back to that idea of kindness, another form of meditation I practice and teach a lot is self-compassion. So I will always include self-compassion practices when I'm working with someone with a health condition, like chronic pain.
That is impressive, and that is so needed. We are unnecessarily hard on ourselves, and there's no need to be. We're the hero of our own movie, our life movie. That's one way of looking at it. When we go to the movie, the person who's having an easy time of it is often not the protagonist or the hero. The hero is having everything go wrong, but we have faith that they're going to be able to resolve the circumstances, whatever they are, by the end of the movie. And we're able to recognize the heroic through the fictive figures or the historical figures whose biographies we might be interested in or whose careers we've been following, but we don't cut ourselves the same slack. And a lot of people I found, it's very sad, see themselves as bit players in their life's unfolding. So it's very important to have compassion with yourself and be kind to yourself.
Yes, absolutely. And I think I couldn't agree with you more. This idea that we're the only ones who are having difficulties in our lives, challenges, is simply not right. Everybody, every human being experiences difficulties in their life. That's part of being a human being. It's our commonality. And, I think when you practice self-compassion, you become aware of that, and you're able to be more compassionate to other people as well. So it's a great practice to have in your back pocket, and it also really helps you be more resilient to those ups and downs when you're able to be less harsh with yourself and more compassionate. It's not giving yourself permission to to be selfish or think, oh, woe is me. Really, that's not at all the case of self-compassion work. It's really the opposite. But it's about understanding that you are not alone. And, looking at what is happening right now in a mindful way, can really help us, I think, to be better human beings.
that's a very good point. And in my past, when I used to supervise student interns in psychiatric settings, these types of issues used to come up all the time, and we focused on them. But self-compassion is a biggie for a lot of people. A lot of people they have internal voices that, when they take a time to look at them, it's usually their parents or some friends or relatives or somebody in a religious or cultural position of authority who said those things to them. And those things remain. And the original voice might be obscured, but it's still there. And that is more common than one would want to be in this type of world. Can you give us an example of a self-compassion exercise? Because I believe people would benefit greatly from that.
Absolutely. So I'll just define what self-compassion is, and then I'll give you a couple of ideas about practices. So self-compassion is the practice of self-kindness, so looking at yourself with kindness rather than judgment. So again, noticing that negative critical voice and seeing if you can be friendly to it and to yourself. Noticing and observing your common humanity so that you're not alone in feeling that there's challenge in your life, and then doing it in a mindful way. So like I said before, not catastrophizing or thinking this is the worst thing that ever happened to anyone else. It's again just looking at it in kind of with perspective, with what's happening right now in this moment. So that's the definition of self-compassion. And if anyone's interested in self-compassion, I highly recommend the work of Kristin Neff, who she has the Center of Self-Compassion, and she does a lot of stuff online, so you can find out about her. And she wrote a wonderful book called Self-Compassion. But the way that that can be useful to practice self-compassion. And again, in a very short practice, is simply if you're experiencing something challenging, and it needn't be anything particularly big, you know, maybe you've just had a difficult phone call, or you've got an email come through that's, you know, making you think, or you've just been in a driving and someone's been, you know, challenging to drive alongside. Just say to yourself something like, well, that's a challenging moment. Everybody has challenging moments, and that was my one right now. And then just have a notice how it makes you feel. And I put my hand on my heart when I do that kind of practice and just soothe myself a little bit, literally by using some touch. We're soothed as babies with touch, so we can soothe ourselves and our nervous system will respond to give us a little bit of dopamine, you know, the feel-good hormone.
Uh-huh.
We do that. So that's a very quick and easy self-compassion practice. Longer practices, they're sometimes called meta-practices, are saying self-compassionate phrases. Usually we start with ourselves and then we work out. But like you were saying, I think a lot of people find bringing self-compassion to themselves quite challenging. Certainly when I've been working with mothers particularly, that's been a group that offering themselves self-compassion quite hard. So I usually start with offering kindness to someone else. So you'll think of someone in your life that you love or who you think is kind and saying some phrases to them like, may you be kind, may you be healthy, may you be happy, may you be at ease. And then you visualize them saying it back to you. And then you see if you can say it to yourself. And then you see if you can say those phrases to someone you don't know. And then to someone that you have difficulties with. And then you send that compassion out into the world. And that's the practice.
That's a beautiful practice. And that is something that will make you feel better.
Yes, absolutely. The lovely thing about self-compassion practice is you practice it for yourself, but actually it makes other people around you more compassionate. It's just like this ripple effect. There's tons of research around it. It's sort of like if you want to change a community to be kinder, to be more compassionate, start with yourself and start using these practices for yourself, and then just sort of watch it ripple out away from you. So I think it's a really beautiful practice. It's one of my favorites, and it's so needed as well.
I believe so as well. In my Age of Heroes initiatives, pretty much we encourage people to work on the world regardless of how they define it, like their own life, their family's life, their community's life, you know, however they define their sphere, and act to make that sphere better for the people in it. And, you know, try to create a better life, try to create an easier life for the people in your immediate circle. And again, that can be a small circle or a huge circle. And the ripple effect you're describing is very real, because if you give the people next to you a good day as often as you possibly can, when they're out there getting stressed by the world and interacting, they're less likely to respond to it negatively and contribute to it.
Absolutely. And actually, I was talking to someone earlier about compassionate leadership in the workplace. There's now a drive to teach compassion to leaders of, you know, big companies, because it makes them resilient leaders and better managers, and their staff are more productive from this ripple effect. You know, I think we underestimate kindness, perhaps thinking it's something weak or something that we don't necessarily need to practice. But actually, when we do, we build these very strong, resilient, creative, productive communities or businesses. So it's a really useful practice, very important. And it blends itself with emotional intelligence, which is something we also talk about a lot with the kind of work I do, which is building up your understanding of who you are, your emotional life, again, makes you both a better human being, but also a better resource for your community, whatever that community is.
Oh, very true. And, you know, a lot of people, you know, you allay their fears, you reduce the amount of suspiciousness they may have. Again, if you're kind and compassionate, it goes a long way. Now, are there any other types of techniques you can provide to our listening audience?
Oh, my goodness. There are many. Shall we do another practice together? Would that be something that we could do?
Then let's talk about the wonderful work you're doing with libraries.
Sure, absolutely. So a practice, because we've talked about the breath practice. We use the anchor of the body and the breath, and we just talked about self-compassion. So let me talk a little bit about a focus practice, because that's something that comes up as one of the real benefits that the communities that I teach in libraries like. So again, just setting yourself up, feet on the ground, feeling that sense of groundedness from the feet coming up into the legs and into the seat, settling your sit bones down into the seat and sitting upright but not uptight. And this practice, we're going to start with our eyes open. It's called the 5-4-3-2-1 practice. And the first part of it is to use the sense of sight. So just inviting you now to look around the space that you're in and find five things that you can see. And perhaps just inviting you to look at those things for a little bit longer than you would normally. So looking at reflections and colors and textures. And as you see something, just saying, oh, I see this. I see a glass, I see a lamp, I see a chair, etc. And then inviting you, if you'd like, to close your eyes for the next part of the practice, just because it helps me and perhaps you to be more keyed into your senses. The next part of the practice is to notice four things that you can hear right now. So that might be outside of the room you're in, it might be inside the room you're in, it might even be from within your body. Four things that you can hear. Again, just sort of noticing the tone, the length of the sound, it's consistent, constant. And then three things that you can feel right now. So that might be clothing against your skin. It might be some air exchange. It might be your sit bones feeling connected to the chair, hair on your head. And next, just noticing two things that you can smell right now. So it might be, you know, cream you're wearing, something in the air around you. And the last part of the practice is just to notice taste. Can you taste anything right now? Maybe something you've just eaten or drunk. Maybe even the taste of what what your mouth tastes like, that neutral taste. And then I just, at the end of the practice, I always ask people, have you noticed anything here that you generally wouldn't have noticed otherwise? And usually there is something. So I'm inviting you to open your eyes and reorientating yourself back into the space. So Hercules, I'd be interested to find out, did you notice anything using your senses that you hadn't noticed before in that practice?
No, I meditate a lot, so I noticed it before. But what was interesting to me is where I had choices of things to focus my sensory input on. The choices that I make, because I could have picked one of 1,000 things to look at in the office where I have my my computer, but I tended to notice specific things that had certain meanings for me. And then I was wondering if I was doing that with the other sense also, that later on I'll meditate on it to see if my choices were affected by any external factors.
That's a very interesting way of looking at that meditation. So from a mindfulness perspective, we're just looking at what is happening right now in this moment. So not necessarily thinking about, does that have any additional meaning to me? But I can see that that is also a good way of meditating. So, yeah.
Well, I'm impressed. It was very interesting. And I know that once I closed my eyes after the looking exercise, I was honing up on my imaging skills, too. All those exercises paid off. I was able to remember details in the 5 things that I looked at initially, very clear details. So that popped into my head while I was doing the exercises.
Absolutely. It's a simple exercise to use the senses to bring yourself back to the present moment. It's taught a lot by therapists helping people with anxiety, because anxiety tends to be, future thinking. So
yes,
Anything that can bring yourself back to the present can be very useful. And the mind tends to be happier in the present moment just because of the neuroscience behind the way the mind's working. So it's a good tool to have in your back pocket.
Oh, it certainly is. And thank you for your generosity in sharing these techniques, because I can see how each one of these would be invaluable in one's optimal wellness. So thank you. And you're doing work with libraries, as you mentioned before. And what type of work have you been doing in the libraries specifically? Because there you'll get a lot of people of different ages and different circumstances.
Yes. Now, one of my big aims with my work is to work in the community, because I think that these tools are so important for community health. We've got a lot of issues in all of our communities with mental health. This is my offering back to help people, to build these tools into their own life, to build mental resilience, to build brain health. So I offer up a library program. I've been sponsored by a few libraries for the past year, and I'm hoping to bring it to some new libraries this year as well. We meet on Friday morning at 9:15, and I have a very wide range of people who come to the class. It's a lovely group, and I lead it. It's about 45 minutes a class, but it's about 30 minutes of practice and then 15 minutes of discussion at the end. So I have a theme for the month, and it changes each month. In September, we're going to be looking at balance, because that's a good time, back to school, work-life balance, how to bring balance into our life. We discuss a little bit of the theory behind that. Then we do a little bit of movement practice to settle the body, and then we do a sort of 10 to 15 minute meditation practice. And then, as I said, we finish with the discussion group. And I found that this way of teaching has been a lovely way to foster community, and I've had some great results with it. So I'm looking forward to growing that. So that's one of the major ways that I work with the library system. The other way I do is I do one-off workshops or multiple workshops. So with the Tenafly Library coming up in September, I will be teaching three stress management or back to school with less stress workshops to teens. We'll be looking at one using meditation, one using breath work, one using movement. So bringing these tools into our teens' life to help them manage the stress of school. And I also teach one-off workshops all over the Bergen County Library System, teaching both movement and also meditation for different topics like stress management, emotional regulation, introductions to mindfulness. I'm also going to be teaching parents how to help parents with stress management in the family.
Wow, that's quite comprehensive.
Yeah, I was just saying that I'm doing a lot. But, you know, there's a real need. I think these ancient practices stemming from, you know, contemplative practices and yoga, there's a real benefit to them in modern life, you know. They really are filling up a hole of, you know, some of the difficulties that people are facing. They help with stress, they help with overwhelm, they help with anxiety, they help with just managing to find balance and managing distraction and finding focus. So, you know, I think they can be really helpful to everyone and you know, in your life.
How do you think the information age has affected people? Like, I'll give one example from my life. I love to read. I don't read as much as I used to, but I used to read a book a day for most of my life. And books were hard to find, you know, some of them.
Mm-hmm.
So you had to search in libraries, you can get into the library system. You had to go to antiquarian bookstores sometimes. You had to go to all sorts of places. And then they would look for this for you. Something took as long as a year to get it, and so on and so forth. So information, especially if you're studying things that weren't like common things to study, it would take a very long time to get to you. And then, you know, you had to spend time digesting it and so forth. Now you can type it into a search engine and you could have several translations of it available, archived somewhere, you know, online. So all of those months that were spent on seeking and waiting and digesting the information now are pretty much gone, you know, or greatly minimized. And I'm finding in my life that much as I am interested in the world and everything that's going on in it, that I really can't spend my time just generally picking up information, because then there's no life to live if all my life is being eaten by picking up news, you know, bits of news. So I've become very selective about how long I look for information and what type of information I am looking for, and why am I looking for this piece of information. Sometimes it can be just for recreation or enjoyment, but I found that the sensory overload and the speed at which information is hitting us was too much for me to process. Is that something common? What other types of things are people reporting about this new computer age we're in?
Yeah, so absolutely, it is very common. So the speed that the information is coming at us is actually much faster than our ability to process it. And it's leading many people to feel overwhelmed, that there's just so much to do, there's so much to see, there's so much to absorb. It's too much. Like, it's faster than our brain is able to absorb information. And, you know, I think you're wise to figure out and put some boundaries around you're consuming of information. There's an emotional toll that can take place as well with that sense of overwhelm, and having this information coming at us so quickly. It can make our systems feel stressed as well. And also distracted, because again, if you can't really sit with something for long, you don't need to, because you've got it at your fingertips and you're constantly just churning through it. The ability to sit and be with something for longer, to be focused, doesn't get developed as much or gets lost. So that's consequently why you know, focus levels in school kids is declining. The ability to sit still, or not to sit still, to be able to focus on something and problem solve on one thing for longer, it's difficult for some kids because of that.
What would you like to see in terms of mindfulness classes? How much of society would you like to pervade, and how much should they be a part of our daily lives?
So I think that every single person can benefit from mindfulness and self-compassion practice. I think that everybody should at least be exposed to it so that they have the knowledge that there are tools that they could use in their life, no matter where they are or what's happening to them, to help them deal with the ups and downs of life. The Dalai Lama has said that if every 8-year-old child learned meditation, there'd be no more war. And, you know, I see great transformation possible with these tools. It's one of the reasons why I'm so passionate about sharing them with my community.
Well, thank you about sharing them. Thank you for sharing them with us today. Wow, this was amazing. How can people reach you? And where can they go to get a sampling of your work?
So my website is findthatcause.com. You can find lots of information about me there. If you sign up for my newsletter, I send it out once a month, and it always includes the meditation as well as a little bit of theory about a theme I'm thinking about. So that would be a good place to start. And then look out for me. I'm teaching in Tenafly, like I said, in the fall. I'll be teaching in Englewood as well. Love to see more people. Love to spread this work to everybody.
Thank you. I'm looking forward to working with you, like I said, and I'm really glad we had this conversation, and I'm already planning the chakra conversation that we'll have at some later point. If you send me links to your places where you'd like people to focus their energy, I'll gladly share them, and please feel free to post in the groups that we have on Tenafly Wellness, anything you happen to be doing in Tenafly, because like you said, people should be exposed to it and they should know that it's there, and hopefully they can try it and benefit from it.
Thank you so much, actually. Yes, I'd love that.
And are there any last thoughts you'd like to leave with folks?
Yes. To be open and come and see what mindfulness is like for you. Come and practice it. See for yourself what it's like. It is a practice, so it's great to talk about it, but it's in some ways more insightful, I think, to practice it.
Thank you so very much, Miranda. And thanks to our wonderful audience. Whether you clicked on a link and found yourself here, whether you called and you're patiently waiting in our queue, or whether you're going to check us out later on demand. Until next time, this is us wishing you joyous journeys and amazing adventures. And thanks again, Miranda.
Thank you so much, Hercules. Have a great evening. Thank you.
You too. Good night.
Good night.